U.S. President Trump and the U.S. delegation greeted at the palace by several dozen elementary school children waving Japanese and American flags as the delegation that kicked off a series of meetings Monday in Japan. Mr. Trump became the first foreign leader to meet with the Emperor Naruhito, who ascended to the throne May 1st. He also began a four-day visit to Japan on Saturday and started his formal visit Monday, meeting with Naruhito and Empress Masako. Trump and First Lady Melania Trump took part in an elaborate welcoming ceremony at the Imperial Palace. No quick breakthrough on trade is expected, although both leaders have expressed a desire for a bilateral trade pact. House Democrats remain divided on the question of whether to impeach President Trump. We get more from AP correspondent Mike Hempen.
Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, who chairs the House Democratic Caucus, says the party needs to focus on its agenda.
We'll proceed as Speaker Pelosi has eloquently laid out, methodically yet aggressively, to get to the truth.
But Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib believes more Democrats are favoring impeachment.
I think it is moving towards that. It's going to demand it. It already is.
Jeffries and Tlaib spoke on NBC's Meet the Press. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham tells Fox News Sunday that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is battling her members.
She knows an impeachment would be political suicide.
Fewer than one-third of the 23 Democrats vying for the presidential nomination have called for impeachment. Mike Hemp in Washington.
And you can find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. At least three people were killed, several dozen wounded Sunday morning when Pakistan's security forces and protesters skirmished at a security checkpoint in North Waziristan. The military blamed the incident in North Waziristan, close to Afghanistan's border, on leaders of the PTM, a local rights movement. The country's sitting government supported the military's version of events, while several of the largest opposition parties seemed to be supporting PTM after the incident. Smaller European parties saw a surge of support in a continent-wide election for the European Parliament, and what politicians and analysts agree will likely be seen as the most consequential since 1979, when European Union voters first began casting ballots for the bloc's legislature. Early results Sunday suggested the 751-seat parliament will be more fragmented than ever before. Smaller parties, both Eurosceptic and pro-EU ones, fared well at the expense of their more established and bigger center-right and center-left rivals. Meanwhile, as Reuters' Vanessa Johnston reports, as French President Emmanuel Macron tries to move the European Union towards tighter integration, his centrist alliance suffered a defeat.
Celebration at a rally for France's far-right nationalist party led by Marine Le Pen, as exit polls showed it just ahead of President Emmanuel Macron's centrist alliance Sunday. Its anti-immigration, anti-Brussels platform leading a nationalist surge in Sunday's EU Parliament elections. It was only a narrow victory, just one seat, but it was a bitter pill to swallow for those who had hoped voters would heed Macron's message and embrace Europe as an answer to its economic challenges rather than see it as a problem. Overall, official projections showed pro-EU parties held on to two-thirds of the seats in the EU Parliament, with Liberals and Greens making big gains.
Reuters' Vanessa Johnston. As tensions continue to escalate between the U.S. and Iran, Iran's foreign minister has met with top Iraqi officials amid signs of diplomatic initiatives with the Gulf states. Ed Uranian reports for VOA.
The 48-hour visit to Baghdad by Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif follows recent protests by supporters of Iraqi cleric Muqtada Sadr calling for a peaceful resolution to the current escalation of tensions between the U.S. and Iran. During a press conference Sunday with his Iraqi counterpart, Zarif insisted Tehran was still abiding by the 2015 nuclear accord with the P5+1 group of countries.
That's Ed Uranian reporting for VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bungani in Washington, and today is Monday, May the 27th. Here's some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. The Rwandan government has issued a communique dismissing allegations by the Ugandan government that its soldiers infiltrated Ugandan territory and killed two people. Authorities in Western Congo say that at least 30 people are dead and another 200 are missing after a boat sank in a lake. The dead are mostly local teachers who are traveling to collect their paychecks. This story is still developing. Protest leaders in Sudan issued a call for a two-day general strike starting tomorrow, Tuesday, pressured the ruling military council to transfer power to a civilian-led authority.
The military council has ambition to continue ruling the country the way the former dictator Omar Bashir was doing. They are considered as an extension of that previous rule. They are rejected by the people.
That is Sudanese human rights lawyer Salih Mahmoud Osman. Security sources said that gunmen burst into a church in northern Burkina Faso on Sunday and shot four people dead. This makes it the fourth attack on Christians in that part of the country. And in East Africa, small-scale farmers are calling for member states to implement the Malabo Declaration that calls for countries to allocate at least 10% of their annual budget to agriculture.
Famine and food insecurity will increase in Africa and in most in the East African community, as already seen in many parts of the world, of our countries.
Stay with us. Those stories plus sports are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Authorities in Western Congo say at least 30 people are dead and another 200 are missing after a boat sank on Lake Maindombe. The mayor of Inongo, Simon Mbu Wemba, told the Associated Press that many of those aboard the boat that sank were teachers who were traveling to collect their salaries by boat because roads in the region are so poor. And security forces in Burkina Faso said that gunmen burst into a church in the northern part of the country on Sunday and shot dead four people. Other worshippers were wounded in the assault on the morning service at the church near the town of Titao. No one has claimed responsibility for the attacks, which threatened to upend traditionally peaceful relations between the Muslim majority and Christians, who make up a quarter of Burkinabes. The head of Sudan's military council met Abu Dhabi's crown prince on Sunday. Lieutenant General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan's visit to the UAE came on the heels of a trip to Egypt and a visit by his deputy to Saudi Arabia. Now, many observers are questioning the role of external players in what is appearing to be a political stalemate in Sudan. They are accusing the countries like the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt of trying to consolidate their influence after the fall of longtime President Bashir. Both the UAE and Saudi Arabia have pledged a combined $3 billion in financial and material support to Sudan. Meanwhile, Sudan's main protest group, the Sudanese Professionals Association, said that it held its first meeting with the Saudi ambassador in Khartoum, calling on him to support their cause. The Sudanese Professionals Association is also calling for a two-day general strike starting tomorrow, Tuesday, to increase pressure on the ruling military council to transfer power to a civilian-led authority. However, in what many see as a divide in Sudan's pro-democracy movement, tomorrow's strike is being opposed by another prominent opposition figure, Sadiq al-Mahdi. To help us understand some of the dynamics at play in this ever-evolving situation, I reached Salih Mahmoud Osman, a prominent human rights lawyer based in Khartoum. He tells me that without pressure from civilians, the military council is not bound to give up power.
Negotiations led to a situation where the military council has ambition to continue ruling the country the way the former dictator Omar Bashir was doing. They are considered as an extension of that previous rule. They are rejected by the people here. And I think this is also very important to mention that continental institutions like the African Union has declared this military council as unconstitutional, and they asked them to step down and handle authority to a civilian-led government.
So Tuesday, the main protest group is calling for a sit-in, a continuation of the sit-in. One of the main opposition figures, Sadiq al-Mahdi, he has said that he's opposed to the sit-in. Is it fair to say that the objections of Mr. Sadiq al-Mahdi will resonate with some sections of the protesters? Do you think they will take him seriously?
I think the general understanding that Sadiq al-Mahdi's position has been already or always suspicious. And he was very, to some extent, very close to the former dictator Omar al-Bashir when they agreed that they should participate in the government immediately before the uprising. And then now today he's also talking to the council and threatening people not to talk adversely against this council, which the reaction is that large numbers of the protesters and the people in general are now of the opinion that he very much cooperating with the military council, which is very much rejected by the people.
So let's talk about the role of some external players, including countries like the United Arab Emirates, Egypt and others. But yesterday, the head of Sudan's military council met in Abu Dhabi with the Crown Prince. What do you see as the role of external players, countries like Egypt and UAE? What are their intentions? And do the protesters in Sudan actually trust them?
Just to remind you that here we have the decisions of the African Union, which are very clear. Their communique that was adopted in Tunisia on the 30th of last April, which was very clear that African Union condemns and rejects this military coup in Sudan. They voiced out that they will apply the same measures for this military measures that have been used against similar situations in Mali, Burkina Faso, and Cote d'Ivoire. That is the first thing might be suspensions of Sudan in the AU, and again, maybe there will be sanctions also against individuals who are impeding the transfer of authority to the civilian. So in the world, it is only these three countries, Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Emirates. Yesterday, I think President Sisi's statement was, to some extent, rather supportive to the people than it is supportive to the military council, because he said that it is the option of the people of Sudan to determine their future. And this is very legitimate, and there would be no intervention from any other outsiders to decide for the people of Sudan the options. Again, we have now the two left countries, that is Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, which are definitely very much protecting their interests. Again, they have also their interests regarding investments here in Sudan. This is why these are the only two countries in the whole world that they are dealing with this council in a way that they seem to be supportive.
Okay.
But the people of Sudan are very angry about that.
Okay.
People of Sudan are not happy with that position.
Do you see a tendency by the military council to want to talk more with these external powers than actually engage in discussions with the protesters?
Engaging in discussions with the protesters is now becoming very remote option, because the parties are very far away from any agreement in between, because the people of Sudan are saying we don't like any military rule in our country. People have determined that members of this military council should not be there because we might need to apply the theory of transitional justice, and they should not be there in a position in their position to impede the end of justice.
Right. Let me ask you finally, is there a worry amongst protesters and the leaders that the situation will end up in the situation in Sudan will end up like Egypt, basically trading one strongman military ruler for another?
No, we don't have any kind of doubts about the fact that we don't like any military ruler in our country. Circumstances here are a bit different from the situation in Egypt or elsewhere. We have our own situation that is very unique for Sudan. Things might develop into, as I told you, demonstrations, strikes, civil disobedience, but this will always be in a peaceful way, in a peaceful manner.
That's Salih Mahmoud Osman, prominent human rights lawyer, was speaking to me earlier from Khartoum. The government of Rwanda has issued a communique dismissing allegations by the Ugandan government that Rwandan soldiers infiltrated Ugandan soil and killed two people. Rwanda says that the people killed were smugglers that were caught in the country trying to import used clothes. Eugene Uwimana has more details from Kigali.
The government of Rwanda has said that the two men who died following an incident near the border with Uganda were on the Rwandan territory when they confronted Rwandan security forces on patrol. The two killed are John Baptiste Kielenge, a Rwandan national, and Alex Nyesiga, a Ugandan. Rwanda says they were shot after the former resisted arrest and was immediately joined by others who attacked the officers with machetes. However, a note verbalized by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation to their Ugandan counterparts dated May 25, 2019, said the incident took place in Nyagatare district in Rwanda, not in Uganda. A note verbal reads, "The ministry would like to inform that on the above-named date, Rwandan security forces intercepted a suspected smuggler on a motorcycle who had just crossed the border from Uganda at night through an unegazetted border point." This rejects claims by the Ugandan government contained in the protest note sent earlier Saturday that the incident took place over 50 meters inside Ugandan territory. The government of Uganda protests in the strongest terms the violation of its territorial integrity by Ugandan soldiers and the criminal, brutal and violent act of Ugandan soldiers in Ugandan territory against unarmed civilians. The protest note reads in part, "Rwanda and Uganda relations have soared over 4 years ago. Rwanda accuses Uganda to cooperate with the rebels to destabilize the country, as well as violating Rwandans' rights on Ugandan soil. Rwanda's President Paul Kagame said this have started even so long ago."
There are people who have been in a prison in their dozens, actually running into hundreds now. Some of them are in military prisons, others nobody knows. Almost every week, there are people who are brought and dumped across the border. The best way to live there and be facilitated is to say you are there because you are against the government of Rwanda.
Uganda denies all allegations. Instead, it accuses Rwanda to send soldiers to spy on Kampala. Both President Kagame and Kaguta have met several times, but their talks seem to have hit deadlock. They recently met last Saturday while attending Cyril Ramaphosa's swearing-in ceremony. Many activists on social media say they wait to see if something new can emerge from their handshake. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Small-scale farmers in the East African community are calling for member states to implement the Malabo Declaration that calls for member countries to allocate at least 10% of the annual budget to agriculture. The African Union Malabo Declaration of June 2014 is aimed at accelerating agriculture growth and transformation for shared prosperity. Moses Havyarimana reports from Arusha, Tanzania.
During the 4th East African Community Agriculture Summit, small-scale farmers and civil society organizations in the region called on the East African member states to implement the Malabo Declaration. The Farmers Forum is expected to present a petition to the upcoming East African Community Heads of State Summit signed by 1 million farmers, calling for the allocation of 10% of the national budget to the agriculture sector. Hakim Baliraine is the chairman of an association for small-scale farmers in Uganda.
It is now coming to 6 years on the road. Most of the countries have not reached 5%, apart from few. Basically, they don't put more money into the sector. Famine and food insecurity will increase in Africa and in most in the East African community, as already seen in many parts of the world, of our countries.
The African Union Malabo Declaration of 2014 is aimed at accelerating agricultural growth and the transformation of shared prosperity and the improved livelihood, setting up 8 goals by 2025. Among the goals of the declaration is the recommitment to enhance investment finance in agriculture by upholding 10% of the public spending budget and operationalization of African Investment Bank. Matthias Kasamba is a lawmaker from the East African Legislative Assembly.
Young people are losing interest in and appetite with agriculture activities, a situation that, if not addressed, threatens the sustainability of the sector. Partner states need to develop a working framework for involvement of stakeholders in the national budgetary process to discuss budgetary allocation and priorities in the agriculture sector. Domestication and implementation of the Malabo Declaration is the right way to go for the EAC partner states.
In 2016, the Regional Assembly passed the resolution for East African member states to fast-track the Malabo Declaration by putting in place financial instruments which are responsive to the needs of the small-scale farmers. Alfayo Kuruna is the chairman of Association of Small-Scale Farmers in Kenya.
That the needs of the farmers are here, and on top of that, the African government, heads of states, have committed themselves to allocate this fund to agriculture sector. This is actually in to settle the food insecurity in the countries.
Despite agriculture contributing to more than 40% of the region's GDP, there have been a significant decline in the budget allocation by East African member states in agriculture sector. African Union's Malabo Declaration aims to end hunger and reduce the poverty rate in the continent by half in the year 2025. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
The first United Nations Habitat Assembly Summit is kicking off today, Monday, in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. The summit will focus mainly on innovation to transform lives in the global cities and towns. Maureen Ojambo reports from Kenya's capital, Nairobi.
The week-long event that officially begins today, Monday, at the United Nations headquarters in Nairobi will be attended by a number of heads of state, over 40 ministers and high-level representatives from 116 countries. Speaking in Nairobi, the executive director of the United Nations Human Settlement Program, Maimuna Sharif, said that the meeting will have special events, among them conference in support of the Sustainable Development Goals and the New Urban Agenda.
In the urban dialogue, the first thing is the accelerated implementation of the New Urban Agenda towards achievement of the Sustainable Development Goal. And this urban dialogue is also, I would like to commend the National Habitat Committee that has put this together for a job well done. Thank you very much to the National Habitat Committee of Kenya.
In attendance will also be senior representatives of the national and local governments, civil societies and NGOs, business leaders, academics, experts and other United Nations agencies. There will be over 50 side events on topics including affordable housing, the blue economy, livable Somali cities, safe cities for girls, climate action and frontier technology, as well as pressing events on urban displacement. Kenya's Infrastructure and Transport Cabinet Secretary James Macharia said that Kenya has embarked on building of affordable housing for its people, but his ministry faces a lot of challenges in implementing these.
As a country, we feel very privileged that the first ever assembly of this UN body is happening here. As of now, we have deficit of at least 2 million houses in this country. 2 million, at least 2 million. Meaning we have not put enough investment in housing. And this is a challenge for all of us. Secondly, we have not put enough investment in public transport. Because, you know, housing and public transport, they go hand in hand.
Maimuna Sharif, however, said that the assembly's meeting provides an opportunity for member states to inspire each other with new ideas and examples of how innovation has been used to maximize the opportunities offered by urbanization and overcome the challenges.
This urban dialogue is very significant, that it is the first public forum that brings together stakeholders in government in Kenya. It is provides the platform for this effort to reflect and collect issues that could contribute to a successful UN Capital Assembly, which will be launched on the 27th.
Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta is expected today, Monday, for the official opening of the meeting that will come to an end on Friday this week. The UN Habitat Assembly is the highest-level decision-making body focused on sustainable urbanization and human settlement, and the meeting in Nairobi is to frame the global urbanization agenda, pass resolutions, and provide strategic guidance to UN Habitat in its work. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojembo in Nairobi, Kenya.
There is a new political party in Uganda. The Alliance for National Transformation Political Party, or ANT, which was formed by former Army Commander of the Ugandan Army, Mugisha Muntu, promises to unite all Ugandans and bring about the end of the ruling party that has been in power for over 3 decades. And some analysts say that the message brought by the new party is timely. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report from Kampala, Uganda.
While launching the party leadership this past week, Muntu is also the former president of Uganda's biggest opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, said his party will work with other political parties to achieve its objectives.
We know people are angry and tired, but also know that fear and anger quickly turn into hatred and prejudice. A fearful nation is sapped of its energy to seek change on its own terms. Ugandans have been preoccupied with their own divisions, with little time to spare on how to forge ahead as a united force.
Muntu says he built party structures from grassroots levels and appealed to the elites to participate and join his party. He also promised to fight corruption, improve people's livelihoods, and create employment opportunities for the youth, who form the biggest percentage of the population. But Charles Chiza, a professor of international relations and diplomacy at Kampala International University, says Muntu's appeal should start by appreciating the government that he formerly served. I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
And that's it for this Monday, May the 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. We want to thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to African News Service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good week ahead, Africa.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African Music Mix on the Voice of America. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. From the north to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best. Yes, sir.
Tune in at 200, 300, 1200, and 1300 UTC GMT. Every day, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.